Fuck yeah! Spring break forever!
Hello, subway cats and mini fridges full of porn and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick their favorite year of movies and talk to us all about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is a filmmaker, actor, TV writer, and film critic. I know him best as the latter, as we're both members of the esteemed New York Film Critics Circle. His byline has appeared at the New York Times, The Guardian, Variety, and Vulture, among others. He's also directed numerous short films and written video essays, and has won several awards for his film and television criticism. Folks, he's one of the best in the game, and he's also just a really nice guy. This is Mr. Sadant Adlaka. Hey, Sadant.
Hi, thank you so much. That is a introduction that makes me feel very embarrassed because it was very kind.
No, it's honest. There's no lies in it. You're an accomplished gentleman, and we're extremely pleased to have you here. Let's get right to it. What year did you pick for this episode and why?
I picked 2013 for A Very Good Year because for me personally, it was a very bad year.
Oh.
But it was also a year that sort of changed my relationship to cinema in a lot of ways. Okay. That's the short version of it, which I'm sure we'll get into as we go on.
I mean, you can tell me a little bit of the long version now. Where were you at?
This guy really is a writer. Like, talk about crafting an opening sentence.
I know. Where were you at in your life as a critic and as a creative person in 2013? I guess we could start there.
Sure. So this was technically my pre-critic days. I was really just, you know, blogging off and on. But I was actually in grad school for filmmaking at the time. I was, this was across my first and second years of grad school. And I was out in LA. I was at the New York Film Academy in Los Angeles doing the MFA program in filmmaking. I found it frustrating for a lot of reasons. One of which was, the instruction seemed very limited and limiting. And so this is when I started to kind of branch out on my own a bit and see what I could learn by watching as many movies as possible. This was, I think, the first year where I said to myself, okay, I'm going to try and watch pretty much everything I can get my hands on.
Sure. And was there a particular sort of like entry point? Was there something, you know, was there an area in particular that you wanted to address initially, or was it a kitchen sink approach to the art?
I would say kitchen sink for sure. Because I would try and watch any new movie that was out there, not just to get a sense of, you know, what was going on culturally and politically in cinema, but also to see what my read was on films that I liked and films that I disliked. Mm-hmm. And what worked for me and what didn't, and more importantly, why.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time as you're taking all of this stuff in, are these influences beginning to make their way into the work that you're doing at school?
That's a little harder to say, because the way I would work on my short films, it was this sort of instinctive approach that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily take today. It was very like, okay, you know, here's the first idea that comes to me and I would kind of execute it. And then years later, looking back, I would realize, oh, wait, there's a clear influence on the stuff I made. But that influence goes back much, much further to things that I saw when I was a kid or when I was a teenager. And, you know, I clearly wasn't as original as I thought I was, but at the same time, there are these movies that, there are these movies that sort of etch themselves into my memory and my creative DNA. Mm-hmm. And none of those were 2013 movies, because those were still new to me at the time and they were at the, you know, forefront of my consciousness. But I guess looking back today, it's some of these movies that would have kind of burrowed themselves into my understanding of cinema as I look at it today.
Gotcha. And I don't want to jump too far ahead in the time machine, but now you've of course piqued my curiosity, because I've only known you as a critic. So when did that shift occur in your life?
I would say around 2015. That's when I wrote my first paid freelance article. I had just finished grad school and moved back to New York. And the TV and film work was a little hard to come by, but I had to do something just to stay in the country. Because once you graduate, and if you're on a student visa, you have a year during which you're allowed to work. And that work has to be in some way, you know, tied to what your degree was. And mine was in filmmaking, and, you know, film criticism is, you know, it is a, for me, it's always been a critique of filmmaking and not just, you know, film politics, as a lot of criticism has become today. And so that's where I tried to, you know, I guess, apply my understanding of what I'd learned.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked out. It worked out really well.
Here I am. Yeah,
you're very good at what you do, sir. All right. Well, you have put together a marvelously eclectic top five for us. I am very interested to hear your thoughts on these films and why you selected them, and again how they sort of influenced things that you were doing and you're thinking as a budding critic. Before we do that, real quick, Mike's going to fill us in a little bit on what was going on in the world outside of the New York Film Academy in LA. Here's headlines.
2013. It was a busy year watching Obama pretend like Mitch McConnell was a good faith actor.
Yeah, how'd that work out for us?
I mean, man, not well.
Yeah.
Not well. Yeah. It was like there was so much hope. And then, you know, we all voted for him again. And I feel like 2013 was the year that everybody just sort of gave up.
That sounds about right.
Even though some things happened, he got some shit done.
But,
you know, it was just a lot of arguing. Yep. The Supreme Court did something nice. They decided gay people could get married. And then gay people were all like, why do you keep trying to make us straight?
This was back.
The fucking army, marriage.
This was, I think it may be hard for younger listeners to remember, but there was a time when new Supreme Court decisions did not fill your full fucking soul with dread.
Have you ever seen the meme headline, feral pig drinks 18 cans of beer, fights cow, and then passes out drunk under a tree? That was 2013. Shout out to Swino.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, we got hit by a car a month later, which, you know what? I mean, when you burn that bright, your candle's bound to go out quickly, right?
Fair. Pour one out.
Do you remember hairy stockings? A Chinese company started selling hairy leg stockings as a way to deflect unwanted male attention. That's some judo shit, bro. They looked very comfy on the inside, and they were just, they looked like, you know, my legs on the outside.
This is your fourth item in the 2013 headlines. Thank you, Mike.
Have you looked at the actual headlines?
No, I haven't.
God, you want to talk about the Boston bombing?
Yeah.
No, let's talk about Carlos Danger. You remember Carlos Danger? Yeah, buddy.
Remind our younger listeners, please.
There once upon a time was a very powerful, feisty, and actually really pretty interesting and effective congressperson from New York named Anthony Weiner.
Yep.
And the sort of worst thing about him was that his last name was Weiner, and it was like sort of just easy to make dumb jokes about his Weiner. Then we all had to fucking see it on Twitter, and the shit wasn't funny anymore. It turns out he was, although being married to, being married to a woman... who seemed like a very lovely person. He was regularly texting his dick to other people, and it turns out some of them were not actually of age, and he didn't seem appropriately upset about it, to be honest. Anyway, he went from sort of being, possibly the next generation's big thing on the Democrat side because he was powerful and feisty and interesting to just being literally a dick joke, and now nobody's even heard of him anymore. So Carlos Danger was his alter ego, and to be honest, like, he knew him better than we knew him. That's actually an even more appropriate name for him than Anthony fucking Weiner.
There we go.
In other political news, all-time great Canadian Toronto Mayor Rob Ford admitted that was him smoking crack on video.
Yeah.
That was a fucking saga. You remember the Ford saga?
I do indeed. Holy shit. Okay.
Good stuff. The Obamacare website rollout was a massive disaster, which seems like small ball now that literally millions of people have access to healthcare for the first time.
Right.
But it was the BFD of the time.
Yep.
See what I did there?
I do. I remember.
A little extra sauce on it for you.
I remember.
Finally, 2013 was the year Edward Snowden martyred himself so we could all know how the government really works. And if you don't know about Five Eyes, go find out about Five Eyes. The sort of the stuff that came out in the Snowden leaks was something that, like, the most ridiculous left-wing conspiracy theory people had been banging on about for years, but they just seemed crazy. Like, no, they're reading all your fucking emails all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't order pizza without them knowing about it. Da-da-da-da-da. And it just sort of sounded nuts. And then Edward Snowden moved to Russia and told us all that it was true. So 2013 was a crazy year of like being happy about, like, yay, gay people can get married and some people can get health care. And also, you know,
yeah,
they know every single thing you do. And Mitch McConnell can read all your sextings. So keep it in your pants, Carlos.
Boy,
that's headlines.
I don't know if I would have asked you to tie all of the boldface names of that segment together in exactly that way. But thank you, Mike. Sadat, you ready to do a top five?
Let's do it.
All right. So we have decided that we're going to do a non-ranked, non-chronological, non-alphabetical, just kind of a theme-ish, thematically. One just sort of flows naturally into the next. And so in kicking off your look at 2013, what is the first film on your top five?
It's an Indian film by director Anand Gandhi. It's called Ship of Theseus.
You mentioned on your site that you actually took up photography after you lost your eyesight to
a cornea infection.
Yes.
Yeah, true.
Why photography?
When I first started taking pictures, I was very much amused by the character of the perfumer in Tuscan's novel. Just the idea of a man trying to capture every scent, starting from people to the surroundings to experiences, you know, was very much amusing.
This was a first-time watch for both Mike and I. It blew both of us away.
It's like this person has never seen a movie made in America.
Yeah.
Like, they have no idea, like, how stories get told here and just reinvented movies for their own. Like, incredible film.
So for those who haven't seen it, Sadat, how would you, I mean, this is a tricky question to begin with. How would you summarize Ship of Theseus?
So it follows three different, not really interconnected stories, but thematically interconnected stories that all deal with organ transplants and the sort of ethics surrounding them and the personal dilemmas and moral dilemmas that, you know, comes with the territory. But specifically, one story is about a blind photographer who uses a camera that describes sound and color to her to create her art and to create her photography.
Right.
But through cornea transplant, she's able to see again, but that changes what her relationship was to her art. Now she can see, but what she understood as photography is now completely different.
Yeah.
Another story is about Maitreya, played by Neeraj Kabi. He's a Jain monk, a sort of, you know, peaceful, what you would call a Gandhian type of figure, who is against animal testing when it comes to medical practices, you know, because it's a form of violence. But he is diagnosed with liver cirrhosis and he needs a liver transplant.
Right.
But a lot of, you know, India's medical industry and medical industries in general, you know, these procedures are, you know, heavily tested on animals. The medicines are animal tested. So that becomes a religious and spiritual dilemma for him as he faces down death. And then the third story is of a rich stockbroker who gets a kidney transplant, but finds out that that there's a local organ racket, a sort of organ black market of which, right, he may have been the beneficiary. And so he decides to track down, you know, where these organs are coming from and who they're coming from and who the intermediaries are. And it takes him on this sort of global quest. So this is a movie where the journeys are both very internal and external. And what initially drew me to this movie is it takes the, you know, the allegory of the ship of Theseus, which you'll know if you've studied philosophy or seen Marvel's WandaVision.
Various entry points.
Yeah. But no, and the reason I bring up WandaVision is because it takes this philosophical concept of, like, you know, what if you replace the individual boards of a ship? You know, at what point does it stop being that ship?
Right.
Even if you replaced all of the boards. And, you know, in WandaVision, it takes that dilemma and boils it down to, you know, one small scene where these two characters try and apply this philosophical concept to humanity, to memories, to what it, to, you know, and so on and so forth. But this is a whole movie, a 2 hour and 15 minute movie that wrestles with exactly that idea, that what if you could break individuals down to these essential elements, not just physically in terms of their organs, but what their relationships are to their bodies, to their eyes, to their sense of self, their sense of ethics. What if you could isolate, you know, these parts of people and really zero in on what happens to them when those things are thrown into crisis or changed in a very fundamental way? And then it all builds to this, you know, really great crescendo that really makes you reflect on it even further in a way that is completely unexpected. I'm not going to spoil it, but it is absolutely worth a watch.
It's a really moving conclusion, and I sort of, and one of those things that's like that I did not exactly see coming, and then when you get there, it feels inevitable, if that makes sense. That
absolutely,
that, you know, that it's like, oh, of course we were leading to this, of course we were, but it's not the least bit predictable in any sort of a trite way. Can you talk to me a little bit? And I'm really curious about this as a filmmaker, about the form of the film, because that was one of the first things that really struck me about it is how it was only when I looked it up, I sort of paused it midway through because the curiosity was killing me, that it seems so off the cuff and so naturalistic that I was like, is this a documentary? Is this like cinema verite? Are these overheard conversations? And no, it's entirely, you know, scripted, written, performed. But I was really thunderstruck by how off the cuff the whole thing felt.
Yeah, you raise an interesting point about its naturalism, which, and so it might surprise you to learn that the director, Anand Gandhi, his background is in writing soap operas.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah, he has been a part of the writing staff of some of India's most watched soaps.
Wow.
And yeah, this was, and he hasn't directed a movie since then, but, you know, but that alone, like, you know, this movie alone, for me, you know, puts him amongst like the great modern Indian directors. And I think, it's a movie that, you know, goes back and forth between these various characters in different parts of India and the rest of the world. But what I most recall about it, what I most recall being struck by the first time I saw it, was the way it uses the entirety of the frame, the entirety of the, you know, the widescreen frame. I think I don't think it's too much of a stretch to liken it to something like Lawrence of Arabia, just in terms of how it uses every shot, every movement, every corner of what you see is telling a story, whether it's, you know, a small little detail in a room or the way it, light enters through a window, or, you know, where the characters are walking from or what they're walking towards. Every frame is just, it's gorgeous to look at, and it has both an intellectual and emotional impact. And I think that kind of defines what Ship of Theseus is for me, a film that is both intellectual and emotional. And one of the reasons I picked it is because a couple of years prior, I want to say about 2008 or 9 thereabouts, you know, snotty teenager, and I sort of decided at one point, you know, I'm done watching Indian movies for good. Obviously, stupid, but at the time, to me, Indian cinema was just mainstream Bollywood, and it was in a bit of a, you know, it had fallen into a bit of a lull for me, and I had started to explore you know, different kinds of movies myself. And so I decided I'm going to turn my back on it. But 2013 was the year where I found myself returning to Indian cinema. And this is an example of what you would call parallel cinema, the sort of the independent art house kind of cinema that, you know, runs parallel to the mainstream that you don't hear as much about internationally, mm-hmm. especially. Mm-hmm. And this was one that really drew me back in, both as an emotional and intellectual exercise, because that is what it is. It is taking an academic concept. It's taking a thought experiment and translating it into emotions through images. And I think just breaking it down that way into its barest elements, as you would with the Ship mm-hmm. of Theseus experiment,
right?
It in turn becomes a thought experiment of its own. Like, what even is a movie? It is this cross section of visual, emotional, intellectual, visceral, calculated, instinctive. But it's also all those things coming together to form one specific thing.
Yes.
Just the scene with the caterpillar crawling across the floor is like just such a small, tiny, just such a simple shot, such a tiny little concept. But the longer it goes on, the more you actually start to feel dread for this caterpillar, mm-hmm. which is a sort of thing that, like, when you're representing a Jane Monk, being able to sort of give me that feeling is like... That's master level work right there.
Yeah, it's really something. Okay, well, sit down for the next film. I'm imagining this would fall into the realm of the more mainstream Indian cinema you were referencing. What is the second film on your top five?
The second film is Ram Leela by Sanjay Leela Bhansali.
मेरी मर्दानगी के बारे में आप गांव की किसी भी लड़की से पूछ सकते हो मैक्सी भाई रिपोर्ट अच्छी मिलेगी
तेरे तो बिल्कुल ही पानी
The full title and there's a story as to why it has a longer title is Goliyo Ki Ras Leela Ram Leela, or A Dance of Bullets, Ram Leela.
Oh, wow. That's a fucking title right there. Holy moly.
Yeah. Ram Leela is a reference to, you know, a story, a retelling of an ancient Hindu epic, a romantic epic. But yeah, Sanjay Leela Bhansali is, I think, the quintessential modern Bollywood filmmaker because his images and his framing are so large in every way, larger than life and colorful.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, marked kind of a turn for him. This was a movie which, you know, for him marked going even bigger and even more ostentatious. And I've seen almost everything he's made, and this is among the most colorful and celebratory and just sexy and energetic
movies ever made by anybody anywhere on earth.
Like if I had to describe it, it's what if Romeo and Juliet suddenly took a hard left turn and decided to become the Godfather halfway through.
yeah it is. I mean, when we got your year, and I saw that it was going to be, you know, relatively recent. Like, I'm not kidding you. I got excited because I was like, oh, shit. Sadant is going to pick some incredible Bollywood movie that I haven't seen. And it's going to blow my hair off, if you will. And this one did not disappoint. This Ram Leela is intoxicated by the act of making a movie in a way that, like, only the best movies are. It is exhilarating to watch this filmmaker having a great time putting all of this together. And what I thought was what was really wonderful about it, as, you know, an American viewer watching a subtitled, quote unquote, foreign film, is that because it's this familiar story, because it is, at least at the beginning, the Romeo and Juliet story,
mm-hmm.
there were scenes, especially during the songs, where I realized I wasn't reading the subtitles anymore, that I was so drawn in to the compositions, to the camera movement, to the energy of what was happening on screen, that since I kind of knew what was going on, all the way down particulars did not even matter because I was so sucked in to what was happening on screen.
Yeah, and I think intoxicating is the right word. And this was, like I said, with Ship of Theseus, if that was the one that brought me back to, you know, Indian cinema in general,
mm-hmm.
This is the one that brought me back to Bollywood specifically. Mm. So I had seen Deepika Padukone, the female lead, in a couple of other movies before. She first showed up in Om Shanti Om in 2007. Ranveer Singh, who she's opposite, had been in movies before this, but this was my first exposure to him. I had no context going in for who he was, what his deal was. And then he has that opening number mm-hmm. with that just that thundering entrance.
Yes.
And to this day, I rewatch it.
Yeah.
Because it is one of the most fun, what we call hero entrances in all of Bollywood and possibly all of Indian cinema.
Yeah. The two of them together. I mean, first of all, these are two of the most like impossibly beautiful people who've ever been in a movie. But their chemistry together, once they're sharing scenes, like, and in a story like this, that chemistry has to be considerable. It motors the entire thing. If it's not there, the movie falls apart. And they mm-hmm. are so incredible together. Have they continued to work a lot in Indian cinema? Are they still doing it? 'Cause they're both so good.
Yeah, they're still two of the biggest. They did two more together with this director, Sanjay okay. Leela Bhansali, and they are now married.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Yeah. I am unsurprised by this news. Yeah. What are the other two movies? Because I'm going to track those down next.
Sure. There's Bajirao Mastani and there's Padmavat.
Okay.
And, similar grandeur, similarly operatic, but those two are sort of based kind of in real history, but obviously like very fictionalized as well. This movie was originally going to come out with the title just Ram Leela, but because it has these connotations, these religious connotations, there was a lot of uproar against it, and so they kind of had to change the title. This was at a time where the tide was sort of turning in Indian politics. It had been for a long time. Today, things are like significantly worse when it comes to like, right-wing religious nationalism.
Mm.
And an unfortunate part of that is that Bollywood as an industry has just kind of, bent to the will and the demands of the current government. And so people like Ranveer Singh, the actor in this, and just a lot of actors and directors will just become like government mouthpieces. It's kind of gross. But that conversation kind of puts this film in an interesting place, because there are elements of this film that to me are about defying culture and defying tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Like scenes where, for example, where Ram like storms into the opposing family's home and has this fight scene where he slams someone down on the floor on what's called a rangoli, which is a sort of powdered color pattern on the floor, which it has its religious significance. And the fact that he sort of so blatantly and brashly like breaking tradition in such a literal way, And this movie has a lot of that, where a lot of these structures are in place, these rules are in place, and the characters are breaking them in numerous ways, whether it's by opposing religious ideas or opposing cultural ideas. But at the same time, Sanjay Leela Bhansali is a director who has been criticized for his depictions of caste and religion and Indian culture in a way that a lot of people say, supports a very fascist status quo as well. And you do also see some of those ideas here with the kind of gaze the camera has towards, you know, hero worship and a lot of things that I don't think I'm even equipped to fully unpack. Mm. But looking back, a film like this occupies a really interesting place in my mind because I had such a visceral reaction to it.
Absolutely.
That it was like, oh, brain off, only emotions. Whereas today I have no choice but to think of Bollywood in a much, much broader context because of the way it is sort of entwined with modern fascism, which it's always a fun conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. That is fascinating. All right. Well, there's no clean transition out of that. But let's just do it simply. The number, what is, Siddhant, the number three film on your top five for 2013?
Number three, the Coen brothers, Inside Llewyn Davis.
From Academy Award winners Joel and Ethan Coen, the creators of No Country for Old Men and True Grit.
Folk singer with a cat. Is that part of your act? Every time you play a C major, you puke a hairball?
Comes a film that is heartfelt and utterly enthralling. A perfectly pitched masterpiece. The best film of the year.
Do you ever think about the future at all?
You mean like flying cars?
Inside Llewyn Davis, in cinemas January 24.
This is that's about as stark a contrast as you're gonna see between two movies there. From the
I mean, maybe they're both not. Kind of musicals.
That's true. That's very true. With extremely handsome leading men, there's that. Mm-hmm. So what is so special to you about Inside Llewyn Davis?
First of all, the context in which I saw it. It was the first time I'd ever attended a film festival.
Aha.
This was AFI Fest 2013.
Okay.
But also, it was the first time a film overwhelmed me and affected me emotionally in such a profound way, but I couldn't understand why.
Mm.
It was a movie that I really struggled to understand why I loved.
Okay.
And, you know, as a younger viewer or, you know, maybe like a casual audience member, the instinct is to kind of reject mystery and reject ambiguity. And that's, you know, generally a problem with a lot of, you know, modern viewership and discourse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this time I decided to like sort of embrace it a little more until eventually it was pointed out to me. Because I didn't come to this realization. Someone else pointed this out to me that I was also similarly an artist struggling to make meaning and find meaning and figure out whether my art had meaning or whether I had a place in a world of artistry. Mm-hmm. And then everything just clicked. Like, oh, there is something going on just beneath the surface of this movie in a way that I could feel but not see.
Yeah.
And that sort of opened my mind up to like a new way of watching movies.
Yeah. Yeah. When I rewatched this one, I've seen it several times, but I rewatched it before the show. And I always forget because it was framed and it is such a detailed depiction of this specific scene, the folk music scene at this specific moment in this specific place. And so I would imagine that could sort of serve as almost a barrier to not understand a personal connection to it because, you know, you have that sort of aesthetic distance. But I think anyone who has endeavored in a creative way in any field, in any place, at any time, can find that connection to it. That for lack of a less trendy phrase, imposter syndrome. The way that it addresses doing a thing for long enough that you start to wonder if it's not going to happen, and as a writer, the scene that jumped out at me this time, and I've seen this movie, like I said, a lot of times, but the moment that really was just like the little pinprick, is when he's in F. Murray Abraham's office, he's handing him the album, and F. Murray Abraham won't take it from him. he has to like set it down on the desk. This is the tiniest little moment. This and the way that they frame it is very unobtrusive. It's kind of on the edge of each of their shots of the frame mm-hmm. that you see that happen. But I feel like anyone who has ever aspired to be a creative artist can relate to the specific moment that's happening right there. It is devastating to watch.
Yeah. And God, what a central performance too. By Oscar Isaac. No man has ever been more despondent throughout a movie.
Yes.
No movie has ever looked greener and felt as sickly for that long.
Oh God. Yes.
It's nauseating in a very interesting way.
Yeah.
And also something I should mention, this also went hand in hand with, what was for me a very vital piece of film criticism. I can't remember exactly when it was written, when the movie came out, or maybe a year or two later, but Matt Singer explored the idea of this movie as the Coens translating their feelings and fears of what it would be like to lose one another, to lose the other person, and not necessarily going solo as they have recently, but actually losing a person that feels like a part of your own soul.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh wow. That I will find. We're gonna find that piece. I'm gonna read the hell out of it because Matt is fantastic.
Leave it to Singer,
friend of the show. Go back and listen to his episode on 84. And we'll put that in the show notes because that's such a fascinating read. All right, Siddhant, what then is the next film on your top five for 2013?
Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity.
Ah.
We have to go, we have to go, go, go. Explorer's been hit.
What do I do?
Astronaut is off structure.
Grab a hold of anything you can.
I'm really scared.
You're gonna make it, Ryan.
I can't breathe.
Do you got me? Anybody?
Gravity, rated PG-13. Experience it in IMAX 3D.
I feel like like the experience, like this is truly one where if you have the kind of love for this film that I have and that I feel like you have, this is another one where the experience of seeing it for the first time really matters. So what was that experience for you?
It was at the newly reopened Chinese theater IMAX screen.
Oh, God. Okay.
It was opening night, I believe. And I think this is like a 1400 seat theater. And the reason I know this is because I was stunned by how, you know, there's all this chatter beforehand because this big new movie is opening. There's all this buzz around it. And again, any room that has, you know, almost 1,500 people in it is going to be loud.
Yeah.
And the movie begins and there's this huge, like, it starts with like this rumbling crescendo of music and this overwhelming sound. And then it cuts to this serene shot of Earth and then silence. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, I am in this room where moments ago, over 1,000 people were buzzing. And now everyone, you could hear a pin drop. And wow. Everyone is stunned and enraptured by what they're seeing.
Wow.
And it's the kind of movie where you're watching it. And even if you have a very good technical understanding of how cinema is made, and at the time, I don't know whether I did or not. I certainly do now. But at the time, I had no idea how these images were being created.
It's like 2001 in that way of just sort of like, I don't know. I don't know how you did
it's
that.
It's fucking magic. That's what I know. Yeah.
And you mentioned the experience of it. And it was important for me for that specific reason, because something I was really struggling with in grad school at the time was this very regimented instruction when it came to screenwriting and just filmmaking in general. It's very like, oh, here's how you write a screenplay. You write it out according to a beat sheet. Mm-hmm. You read Blake Snyder's Save the Cat, which to anyone listening, to any young filmmakers or screenwriters, please burn that book.
Burn it up.
and there was this saying that a lot of our instructors had that, you know, story is king. And that can be true in some ways, but it was all about, you know, writing out these stories with these preordained beats And, you know, it was about making almost a facsimile of a Hollywood movie.
Right.
Then you watch something like Gravity, where, of course, a story is being told, but it's more about how the story is being told.
Yeah.
Because in grad school, I realized I was being taught to make a movie, but I wasn't really being taught how to tell a story using the tools at my disposal. And then I watched something like Gravity, where it is pure visceral experience. It is terrifying. And it is, by the end, it is so hopeful in a weird way. And I don't know how this movie would play on my television. I haven't gone back to check, but every few years I have the opportunity to watch it in the cinema.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes in 3D.
Yeah.
It's one of the very rare films that I think really, really benefits from 3D. One of the rare films on that scale. In recent years, I've seen some smaller experimental stuff that uses 3D very well. Wim Wenders had another documentary this year in 3D, Anselm. But that's besides the point, which is to say that this was sort of the quintessential 3D blockbuster, not by James Cameron.
Right.
and the 3D worked for completely different reasons.
Here was my experience with this one. And I still get very emotional about it. I saw this in a really different circumstance. I saw this at a press screening. In a, you know, not a large screening room, a fine sized one, a medium sized one. There were a lot of press screening opportunities, and I took my wife to see it with me, which doesn't happen very often. Our schedules don't work in such a way that we can do that. This was 4 to 6 weeks after the birth of our first child, our daughter, our oldest daughter, Lucille. And her mother was in town to help out. And she had said, "You guys get out of the house, go see a movie or something. I'll stay here with the baby, etc." And so I just sort of looked at, you know, what screenings were coming up, because those are free. And this was coming, and I very badly wanted to see it. And I said, "Let's go." So we go to this screening, you know, on a Thursday evening or whatever, our first movie since our daughter is born. There was maybe two or three other single people alone, like in this. So it felt like we had the room to ourselves. And when they get to Sandra Bullock's backstory, I'm sure I've cried harder at a movie in my life before, but I can't think of when that would have been. Mm-hmm. And when she says towards the end, when she tells George Clooney to tell her daughter how much she loves her, you know, the entire movie is a testament to the visceral experiential force. But in that moment, it also became a movie about how movies can move you and touch you and make you feel things. It's one of the most emotionally invested film going experiences of my life.
Yeah, if it's a movie that if you give yourself over to it, it really just it turns you inside out. And I remember there being this one shot of, you know, Sandra Bullock when she, I think, gets inside this other spaceship or this other space station, takes off her spacesuit and just kind of floats there for a little while. And you see she turns upside down and the camera spins and she looks like an embryo in the womb.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time someone who didn't like the movie telling me, like, yeah, we get it, move on, you know, we get it, she's like an embryo. Like, it's not about understanding it intellectually.
Yeah.
Because that to me was such it's a moment of such release and relief that it feels primal in the same way that she's experiencing it as if she's, you know, back in the womb. And it's a moment where I felt like I was floating. I felt like I was in like an amniotic fluid. And I felt at ease for the first time, maybe the only time in the film.
It's a beautiful movie. And I went back, I did watch it at home last week because I have a 3D projector and I have the 3D Blu-ray. and it still thrilled me and it still made me cry. It's a it's an incredible movie.
And before we move on, there is also a connection to some of the previous films. A Bollywood connection, in fact.
Oh yeah,
it's not a major one. At the beginning, the third character, people forget there's a third character in the movie who gets his face caved in by debris.
Yeah.
He's Indian, and at the beginning he is singing a very famous Bollywood song, Mera Juta Hai Japani, which means my shoe is Japanese or my shoes are Japanese. It's from Raj Kapoor's Shri 420 or Mrs. 420, Mr. 420. And 420 doesn't mean the same thing as it does. It's not about smoking weed. It's the sort of criminal code for someone who's a con artist or a fraudster.
I love that. See, we can thread all of these together. Okay, then let's see what connection we can make to the fifth and final movie on your top five.
Short-term 12.
Yeah.
Short-term 12. Remember, you're not their parent. You are here to create a safe environment. Here we go.
See one of the most inspiring films of the year.
Why are you so nice to me?
You are the weirdest, most beautiful person I've ever met.
Critics are calling it a pitch-perfect feel-good film.
You want to hear a story I've been working on?
It's stunning, heartwarming, and heart-rending, and phenomenally moving.
You know we can do this, right?
Short Term 12, rated R, now in theaters.
This is another one that is partially about the circumstances in which I saw it.
Okay.
But, look, I almost hate to say this. Like, I did not revisit this movie before the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's one that I don't know if I'll ever be able to revisit.
Same.
I think it would be too difficult for me to watch again.
Yeah.
Even though it is probably one of my favorite movies ever made.
Okay.
Short Term 12 by Destin Daniel Cretton, better known as the director of Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings.
Yep.
Starring Brie Larson, a.k.a. Captain Marvel. But no, this is a movie that legitimately, I can't think of too many other movies that have launched the careers of
so
this
many
stars.
Yeah.
Brie Larson is in it. Caitlin Dever is in it. Rami Malek, Lakeith Stanfield. Just so
Stephanie
many
Beatriz
people.
Is in it. Yeah.
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 John Gallagher Jr., although I think he had done, you know,
a few
some
things,
recognizable stuff beforehand. Gosh, where to even begin with this movie? It's, you know, it's about this, what do you even call it? This sort of temporary home for...
Yeah, care unit is the technical term for it. Yeah.
Yeah, the sort of temporary home for, you know, troubled or at-risk youth or, you know, it's not quite like a foster system, but it is this, I never use this term ever, but it does feel like a liminal space.
Yeah.
It is an in-between.
Yeah.
You know, it exists neither as a home nor, you know, the outside world. It's somewhere in between, but it is people trying to create a home.
And a family.
And a family, exactly. And Grace, the character played by Brie Larson, you really get a sense of how she sees the world and how she interprets other people's troubles.
Mm-hmm.
She really tries to dig deep into what is bothering these kids and tries to read the ways in which they express themselves, often through art,
mm-hmm.
whether it's through, you know, a song someone has made or a drawing they've made. She tries desperately to, you know, solve their problems, but she's powerless to do so. And at the same time, she is impossibly bad at expressing herself too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this one scene where Mason, her boyfriend, played by John Gallagher Jr., is trying to get her to open up. And you can see that she's on the verge of it, but she just kind of nods her head and says no. Like, it's something she cannot do. Like, being vulnerable is such a terrifying thought. And it's just one deeply powerful scene after the next, whether it's, you know, Lakeith Stanfield just creating a rap about how much he hates his mother, Mm-hmm. Or, you know, Caitlin Dever's character, Jaden, just kind of sitting on the floor and crying, from what I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also these scenes that are just so euphoric and just overwhelmingly, I don't even know if happy is strong enough a word.
Vibrant.
Vibrant, happy, overpowering. Like, you know, John Gallagher Jr. goes back to the home that he was raised in by foster parents. And he raises a toast to his foster parents. And I believe he calls them a king and a queen, I think.
Hmm.
I think. Mm-hmm. I could be mistaken. I could be thinking of a completely different movie. Because, like I said, I haven't seen this movie in 11 years almost.
Yeah.
But it is... You never see these characters again, but it gives you such a vivid portrait of who they are and the kind of lives they try and create for each other and the love that they share. And, you know, everyone else in the movie, from, you know, Grace all the way down, is trying and struggling to do the same thing for other people. It is just a movie about the struggle to live in a society, to quote, you know, my friend the Joker. It is, you know, how do you exist with other people?
Yeah.
You know, what are the structures that we cling to? What, you know, what makes us a community?
Yeah.
And how do we maintain that community while also maintaining ourselves? And I wish everyone involved with this was still making movies like this.
Yeah. Oh, well said.
Thank you. And really quick, the circumstances. So I saw this at the Arclight Theater in LA at a time when, like I said, I was just trying to explore any, you know,
as many kinds
of movies as possible. And I went because there was going to be a cast and crew Q&A.
Okay.
And there were not very many of us in the theater. There were maybe a dozen or fewer. I found out years later that a very good friend of mine was also in the audience. We didn't know each other at the time. But so the cast came in. There were as many cast members as there were audience members, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Caitlin Dever decided to rap Ice Ice Baby for us for no reason, which is great. And also, instead of sitting on the chairs that were laid out at the front, the cast sat on the chairs that were in the first row of the audience, facing us. Like, mm-hmm. their knees were on the chairs and they were like resting against... you know, the tops of the chairs, like they were cool youth pastors or something. And it was a very intimate conversation.
Yeah.
Between two groups of people who were no longer separated by, you know, the wall between artist and audience. And I think that's what watching the movie felt like. It felt like being pulled into this world where you are a part of this family. And then, you know, afterwards, the cast also made us feel like we were part of their family, and that was a wonderful experience.
Wow, those experiences are few and far between, and I completely understand wanting to preserve that movie an ember in that way, and mm-hmm. and not wanting to disrupt it. I totally get it. Sedant, thank you for that really splendid top five. Let's find out a little bit more about the big doings of the entertainment business in the year 2013. Mm-hmm. Here is Mike with the Hollywood Minute.
Hollywood freaks on the Hollywood scene.
Exhausted after that one.
Mm-hmm.
That was good. I've been through every human emotion in those five movies. Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave was the big winner at the 86th Academy Award, picking up wins for Best Picture, Best Supporting Actress Lupita Nyong'o, and Best Adapted Screenplay for John Ridley. Cate Blanchett won her second Oscar, this time for Best Actress for Blue Jasmine, the last Woody Allen movie worth a fuck, and Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto won Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor, respectively, for Dallas Buyers Club. He lost some weight for that one, right?
Yeah, yeah. Sedant, thoughts on 12 Years a Slave and any of those other big Oscar winners?
I found 12 Years a Slave completely shattering, and I mean that in just the best way.
Yeah,
I don't know how it would play to me today, but both times I saw it, one was like a rough cut, like almost a year before it came out.
Oh wow!
And then one was when it opened. It was the first time I sat in a theater and heard people like really audibly sobbing around me. Mm-hmm. And by we, I mean, you know, the Western entertainment industry have really failed Lupita Nyong'o.
Yeah.
She just with the roles that she has and has not gotten since.
I would agree with that. I would also say, you know, I know there was a lot of goodwill towards McConaughey. I think Dallas Buyers Club is a fine performance. I don't think anything he's doing in that movie approaches what is going on in Chiwetel Ejiofor's face in the scene when he is singing. And if you've seen the movie once, you remember that. That close-up of him singing is, as far as I'm concerned, what good screen acting is all about.
And yeah, Matthew McConaughey became the first person to win an Oscar for a TV show. That was...
Damn.
People watched True Detective and were like, we got to do something. We got to give him an Oscar.
Yep. Yeah. Well put. Very accurate.
The year's box office sensation was Frozen, which brought in a staggering $1.2 billion with the B dollars worldwide, as well as winning Oscars for Best Animated Film and for Best Original Song for Let It Go.
I went back and looked at my original, because I reviewed this movie when it came out. And in the long history of me being wrong about shit in print, there may be no better instance than me writing of Let It Go. A couple of the songs are unbearably corny, while Elsa's power ballad, Let It Go, plays like a big chest-thumping showstopper at Celine Dion's Las Vegas extravaganza. Now, I'm not even saying that's inaccurate, but I was certainly wrong about how well-received that particular song would be. Sidon, where do you land on Frozen?
Have you heard that song since the movie came out, Jason? Have you heard that song in your own personal life? I don't know if you've heard that song again since 2014.
Jason has a daughter.
I have two.
You have two daughters, exactly.
So, I've heard your kids play that song, so I know you have.
Oh, God. Sidon, where do you land on Frozen? Or have you seen it since you do not have daughters?
No, I have. And it's another one that... Because of the circumstances in which I saw it, I remain in love with it. It was at Disney's El Capitan Theater, opening night, surrounded by children.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Man, you guys really, you guys have all the best when I saw it stories. That's part of being a critic.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you have to have those stories from before people start inviting you to things, and then it just becomes your life.
Mm-hmm.
So jealous. Mm-hmm. American box office was still in its Underoos era, with Man of Steel, Thor the Dark World, and Iron Man 3 among the year's biggest hits. Other sequels in the top 10 included the second Despicable Me, the second Hunger Games, the second Monsters, Inc., and the sixth Fast and the Furious. Ugh.
I would like to say something about Iron Man 3, which is a movie I love. As a fairly frequent, especially on this show, vocal detractor of the superhero movie. And Sidon, you are, you know, pretty closely tied to this subculture. I feel like you can tell me if I'm wrong or right about this. But my theory has become that Iron Man 3 was the end of the superhero movie. And by that, I mean, I feel like there was a long period from sort of 2005, 2008 up to now, up to 2013, where within the confines of these movies, you had really interesting directors and screenwriters with the leeway to make movies that were idiosyncratic and eccentric and personal, as long as they sort of hit the genre benchmarks. And I feel like Iron Man 3 is probably the last movie that I really felt that way about, because of the way that it was received by a fairly, I get at least vocal segment of its audience that pushed back very vehemently against some of the liberties that Shane Black took with that picture and with the mythos of Iron Man. Is this entirely off base, or is there something in here that makes some kind of sense?
So I'm not the biggest fan of Iron Man 3, but at the same time, I, now that you put it in those terms, there's probably something there, because You know, there is a very personal stamp on it in a way that I don't think there really has been since outside of Zack Snyder.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, its own conversation.
Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily disagree. Yeah.
I really, really like Iron Man 3, mostly because it's a really good Shane Black movie with all the Shane Black stuff, with the self-referential narration, which is in none of the other Iron Man movies. And, you know, with the Christmas setting, it's just like, it feels like a Shane Black movie in the same way that The Dark Knight feels like a Christopher Nolan movie. And I feel like even when they've had directors I've liked in these films in more recent years, there's not really a personal stamp on them anywhere. I did not mean to sidetrack the Hollywood Minute, Mike. What else happened in 2013?
You know, some people died. It's fine.
Okay.
In 2013, we bid farewell to Death Wish director Michael Winner.
Uh-huh.
Check out our episodes on that film and its ilk for some skin-crawling Michael Winner dish. Yeah, that's good shit.
I'll like
Night
that.
Move screenwriter Alan Sharp, sleazemeister Jesus Franco, the always funny Jonathan Winters, visual effects artist extraordinary Ray Harryhausen. That's a lot of those.
There's a little bit syllables. Of a tongue twister. Yeah.
Visual effects artist extraordinaire Ray Harryhausen, exploitation legend Eddie Romero, Enter the Dragon and Black Belt Jones star Jim Kelly, actresses Jean Stapleton and Esther Williams, 70s icon Karen Black. Pour one out for Karen Black.
Friend of the show.
80s icon.
Say.
Yeah, I think so. 80s icon Eileen Brennan, novelist, screenwriter, and genius Elmore Leonard.
Yes.
Western producer A.C. Lyles. Mm-hmm. Stuntman turned director Hal Needham.
Yeah.
Lawrence of Arabia himself, Peter O'Toole, and one of the great actors of our time, James Gandolfini.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that there's a pretty good book about him coming next year.
Mm.
That's a pre-plug, ladies and gentlemen. That's how pro-plug we are on a very good year.
Thank you, Mike. All right, Sadat, you ready for a lightning round?
Let's do it.
All right, you know how it goes. I'm going to feed you a list of movies that came out in 2013. You can comment briefly on each or pass if you wish. And here we go. Lutera.
Understated and underrated.
Only God Forgives.
Ooh, deconstruction of masculinity.
Before Midnight.
Depressingly good.
Spike Jonze's Her.
Lovely.
Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street.
Hedonistic. How is this man still making movies in his 70s? Oh, wait, he's 80 already? He's still doing this? Oh my God, what?
Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim.
Sublime. Fucking sublime. Holy shit. Bring me back to opening night. We are canceling the apocalypse.
David O. Russell's American Hustle. Two by Tom Hanks in 2013. We had Captain Phillips and Saving Mr. Banks.
Really intense and fuck off.
There
fuck
you go.
Off. Fuck off.
A great American drama and fucking Disney propaganda. Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger in Escape Plan.
Novelty factor.
Ridley Scott's The Counselor.
Pretty fucking good.
Need to revisit. I could be wrong. I didn't like it at the time, but I feel like I may have a different read on it.
The Act of Killing.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It took me 10 hours to get through that movie. It is one of the greatest things I have ever seen. Did not put it on my list today because don't want to talk about it. Just not with what's going on in the world right now. The G word, which rhymes with femicide.
Terrence Malick's To the Wonder.
Roger Ebert's last review. Yeah. Wonderful.
Park Chan-wook's Stoker.
Creepy. Written by one of the Prison Break guys.
That is fascinating. Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers.
Fuck yeah! Spring Break forever!
Sam Raimi's Oz, The Great and Powerful.
Skip, bust, didn't see. Goodbye, James Franco.
Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues.
same jokes as the first one, but bigger and less funny.
The Purge.
Standard home invasion movie, weirdly enough. Waste of a concept.
Another Arnold movie, The Last Stand, came out in 2013.
Big Gun.
Steven Soderbergh's Side Effects.
No, I've seen it, but I know I've seen it, but I can't remember it. Pass.
Warm Bodies.
Charming.
The Spectacular Now.
Ooh, I'm a Miles Teller apologist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Spike Lee's Old Boy.
My first Spike Lee movie, and thank God it wasn't my last because I hated it. But love everything else I've seen.
There's been a bit of old boy revisionism lately, a bit of revisionist history happening.
And revisionism or just our esteemed colleague Richard Brody doing his thing? I love you. I love you, Richard. I love you.
I love you however, too, Richard. However, what are you doing with old boy, Richard? Elysium.
Getting hit over the head with an Obama poster.
The Place Beyond the Pines.
Ooh, wish it was as good as some of those long takes.
Evil Dead.
So much blood. So much blood. In a good way.
And finally, Upstream Color.
Like, I don't know if we can talk about it. Like, right. not because, and I don't mean that ironically. Like, no, we can't talk about it. No, like, you can't separate something that is so deeply personal from the person who made it. And he's just a horrible piece of shit. So I don't know if it's worth considering in the canon of great 2013 movies.
There we have it.
All right. You are the king of the fucking lightning round.
That's kind of how you do it. Yeah.
fully descriptive one and two word answers are nearly impossible. And you just hit that on 90% of the movies. You're the king of the lightning round.
Well done.
I am the new Karina Longworth.
Sinat, where can people follow you on social media?
The hellhole known as X, formerly known as Twitter. You can find me at Siddhant Adlakha.
I am Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd, where you can find under my lists the top fives for every episode of the show. Mike, where can people find you?
I am at BrainwashedLib on Twitter and at Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and you think other people might like it too, please do us the solid of leaving us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice. The number of movie podcasts is comically astronomical, so your recommendations really do help us float to the top of that heap somehow. Mike, before we go, what is your favorite movie of 2013?
Man, I've been really hitting the documentaries this year, and I've been starting to feel like I need to not be so documentary heavy. But come on, 2013, we already mentioned Act of Killing. It's one of the best documentaries maybe ever made. Sure. Also, 2013 was The Known Unknown, Money for Nothing, fucking Tim's Vermeer. Have you ever seen Tim's Vermeer?
Yeah, good film.
Tim's Vermeer is a fantastic movie about nothing that actually matters, but a wonderful movie. Fucking Finding Vivian Mayer came out. In 2013,
I love that one.
Again, completely meaningless. Fantastic. Sound City came out in 2013. Muscle Shoals, 20 Feet from Stardom, Jodorowsky's Dune. Like, fuck me, dude. But my favorite one of the year is Let the Fire Burn, which is a documentary about the bombing of the Move family in Philadelphia when a United States city police force went and bombed their own citizens. Killed children, you know, the story is just absolutely terrible. It's extremely important. I feel like it's very under sort of known. It's very well known in leftist protesting police hating circles that I may or may not be a part of, but it's sort of as a story, I think, not a part of our history in the way it should be. Heather Thompson, who wrote Blood in the Water, the Pulitzer Prize winning book about Attica that actually did a lot for that story, has been working on a book about Move that is going to be great. This is going to be very important, and she's going to do the thing that she does. But Let the Fire Burn does the thing that Movies does, which, you know, it's almost entirely found footage. You know, there's not a lot of interview talking head, not a lot of sort of things to read. You are in that moment, in that afternoon, when, you know, the city Police Department of Philadelphia and the fucking garbage mayor they had at that time decided that it was more important to kill these people than to take care of them. And the way that that movie puts you into that day and puts you into the sort of, you know, the horror of those moments. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about June 13th. 1994, right? June 30th, 1994, the movie where, you know, it's all found footage and it's about OJ. And it's sort of, that was a day that you and I experienced in a way that you and I didn't experience, you know, the move day, right?
Yeah.
But the ability for a filmmaker to sort of drop you back into that moment is very, I think is very, very hard to do. I think it's incredibly complicated. And the way that they pull it off and Let the Fire Burn while also telling you everything that you do need to know about that moment.
Right.
Yeah. It's just an absolute fucking masterwork of not just sort of documentary, but of like what makes movies different. Is really on example in that movie. And it's a very important story. How about you?
I was very tempted to go with Francis Ha, but there is an entire ass chapter about it in my book, Fun City Cinema, New York City and the Movies That Made It, available now wherever fine booksellers are sold. So I'm going to pass by that because I have talked about it before, and I'm going to talk about Nebraska, is, you know, Alexander Payne is very much, you know, back on top now, after the D word that we do not name. The Holdovers really is him doing what he does best. Sinan is looking very confused. Downsizing. The unfortunate downsizing. But now that Mr. Payne is back in everyone's good graces, I feel like Nebraska really is the movie the least discussed for any good reason movie in his filmography. And it really got to me emotionally, because it's, you know, it's a movie about being, you know, approaching middle age, and dealing with your parents, especially with your father, and the quirks and idiosyncrasies that have turned into your own neuroses.
If you got a Midwestern father.
Especially if perhaps you have a Midwestern father. And it really is a movie that is about learning to let some things go with these people who you love in their old age. I lost my dad about 6 years after this movie came out, and I'm not exaggerating to say that those last 6 years between us were much smoother because of the effect this movie had on me. It's also an all-time great Bruce Dern performance, like a really incredible piece of acting from him. June Squibb is so good in it. Will Forte is astonishingly good in like the lead, basically. And also this was the movie that first sort of indicated, oh yeah, Bob Odenkirk can pull his weight as a dramatic actor. Isn't that interesting? Track it down. It's also, I think, his most aesthetically impressive movie. It's shot in beautiful black and white. Not a movie that people talk about much, but one that's well worth your time.
It's also an example of something that Payne does well that not very many people do well. That he's good at that sort of movie differently than most other people, and it's really on evidence in Nebraska.
Great
choice, buddy.
Really good movie. All right, thank you again, Sedant.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
And if you're still recording...
Yes.
Since we spent the whole episode talking about my favorite movies, I'm going to sign off by quoting my favorite trailer from 2013.
Oh, great.
There's only a few things I care about in life. My body, my pad, my ride, my family, my church, my boys, my girls, my porn. It was a very...